Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. This week on the Garden DC podcast, we're joined by Peggy Cornett. She's Monticello's historic gardener and curator of plants. She's also a researcher, author, editor, international lecturer, and educator. Welcome, Peggy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Peggy, you're down in Charlottesville, Virginia. How is the weather down there this week?
Well, it's been hot for quite a while, up in the 90s. But today is overcast and rather cool, and we may have some rain. So we've had periodic rains throughout the month. So it's not been as dry as it usually can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much the same here in the D.C. suburbs. We're having a nice light rain today for once, not a gully washer. That's always good. And I know Monticello means little mountain, and it literally is a little mountain because when you're on the top of it, sometimes the weather up there can be completely different than down below. I recall some past Heritage Harvest Festivals where I had to wear gloves in the first week of September because my hands were freezing off.
Yes, it can be very unpredictable, especially coming up in the fall, but... Yeah, Jefferson once wrote that on top of Monticello, you look down into the workhouse of nature. And so, we can have just about anything. And sometimes I'll drive into work and it's perfectly clear in Charlottesville and I'll get halfway up the mountain and we're just socked in fog. So it's definitely a different climate sometimes.
Yeah, I do recall some of the fog, sitting in the fog up there and waiting for that to clear. But that creates a nice microclimate for growing. And I imagine that when Thomas Jefferson scouted out the location to put Monticello, that was obviously a big factor.
Absolutely. He was very cognizant of the climate at Monticello and also the way in which the garden was facing. He situated the vegetable garden in a very ideal location on the southeast slope of the mountain so that he could capture, extend the seasons in both directions. We really avoid a lot of the late spring freezes and early frosts in the fall. And we're probably almost a full zone warmer in the vegetable garden because of its location. It's protected from the north winds because it is down the slope slightly from the top of the mountain. And that southeast exposure is really quite ideal for growing a vegetable garden for long seasons. Of course, it's very hot in the summer.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, it's also very exposed to the sun in the summertime. So it does make it really hot on that side.
It can be brutal. Yes, you're right.
But you do have that little brick tower in the middle, and I'm just blanking on the name of it, and that's kind of provides a little bit of shade.
That's right. It's a garden pavilion. Jefferson called it a temple in the garden, and it's really a beautiful structure. We reconstructed it from the original, which was destroyed in a storm toward the end of Jefferson's lifetime. But the pavilion actually stands at the midpoint of the 1,000-foot-long vegetable garden terrace. So you're at the 500-foot point of the vegetable garden, and it's a cube. It's 12.5 by 12.5 by 12.5 feet, which is pretty neat. And it has it's a lovely structure. It's a place where Jefferson was. It was said that he would go there and sit and read and observe, his garden and the orchards below. And you can see about 40 miles from that location toward the Piedmont of Virginia. So, and today we're very lucky to still have a very uninterrupted view from that point. There are no cities or tall buildings or anything that have come up or developments even. So it's very rural in that location. It's quite lovely. Some visitors call the view from there the sea view. Some people called it his sea view. It's like you're looking out over the ocean.
I don't think we could quite see that far, but there's some, yeah, beautiful rolling hills in the distance, and I've taken some really nice photos from that vantage point, but I can see why he picked that midway point. It's a really nice resting spot, and that does bring up a good point that a lot of us don't put a place to sit and enjoy in our edible gardens. You know, you might have a bench or two and you're ornamental, but usually there's no place to rest or sit or just even take notes in your edible landscape.
That's an excellent point. And I believe that the garden pavilion was a place for Jefferson to take notes, and because he did keep a garden book throughout his lifetime and wrote down, documented what was in the garden. He kept lists and diagrams, and he was really writing in this garden book from the time he was in his early 20s until he was 2 years before his death, and 1824 was the last entry. But yeah, I think having a place to sit is so important, just to, you know, take it all in.
Mm-hmm. And so lucky to have that type of record keeping to as a resource for today's gardeners and for obviously historical purposes in the garden. And before we dive into that a little more, let's talk about your background, Peggy. What made you a plant person?
Well, I always give my mother credit. She was really into vegetable gardening, and as a young child, I was involved with her half-acre garden in our backyard, and she grew up on a farm and was very, you know, a self-sufficient farm actually in West Virginia. So she was just kind of a vernacular gardener in many ways. She had some very interesting ways of keeping birds out of the garden by hanging pie tins in the trees and that sort of thing. And but she was really well known for her ability to grow a lot of vegetables. So I grew up with that. And then when I went to college, I decided to go to Chapel Hill in North Carolina, UNC Chapel Hill. And I wanted to study horticulture, but they didn't have a horticulture degree. So I studied botany, and I did a dual major in botany and English. And I think that was a terrific background for my career, because I really love botany. I love native plants and the study of taxonomy, and field botany basically is what I'm most attracted to. And of course, ecology, and that, you know, was during the environmental movement. So it was an important time in my life to really learn about nature. And from there, I worked at a private, I worked at Old Salem in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, which is a restored Moravian village. It's quite an interesting place. It's really covers up about 100 years of settlement in Winston-Salem. And I worked there for a year, and that's where I got interested in garden history. And I was actually a gardener there, but also a costume interpreter in the garden, which was kind of fun. And I learned a lot about, you know, what's involved with garden interpretation and garden research. So after that, I worked for another couple of years in a private estate, the Haynes family estate, which Haynes Hose Company. I worked for the matriarch, and she had a beautiful garden that was just designed by Ellen Biddle Shipman in the early 20th century. So again, this was a more recent historic garden in a sense. And so I was introduced to that period of gardening, you know, the country life in America kind of period of gardening. And so then that once from there, I was so lucky to get a scholarship to go to the University of Delaware and the Longwood graduate program. So that's where I really focused on garden history, the history of annual flowers. That's what I wrote my thesis on. And it was eventually published into a book by Dumbarton Oaks. It's called Popular Annuals of Eastern North America. So and so the rest is kind of history. I go on from there to work at Oak Alley Plantation for a couple of years. When I was finishing my graduate thesis. The director of this historic house, this historic plantation on the banks of the Mississippi River, was looking for someone to be the director of gardens there. So I took this job, which was quite an experience, working with 300-year-old live oak trees and, you know, lots of grass that grows every 5 days you have to cut, and just a very lush landscape. So that was shortly after that, I was able to come to Monticello. I started working at Monticello in 1983. So I've been here for 37 years. Yeah. Where I've ended up landing.
Wow. And I'm glad you found your home, and that's quite an experience and background, but I love the turn of phrase vernacular gardener. I'm going to have to adopt that. Maybe make a couple of t-shirts and say, I'm a vernacular gardener. I just love that. So with starting at Monticello 37 years ago, how has it changed? How has the visitor experience changed?
Yeah, Monticello has gone through a lot of evolution since I've been there. When I first started, we had just completed the restoration of the vegetable garden terrace, and that was all really based on archaeological investigation. They had we knew Jefferson wrote about the garden, but everything was verified by archaeology. So it was one of the first and kind of premier landscape restorations that was really based on this scientific study. And so our first efforts when I started in 83, we were really looking for historic varieties to return to the vegetable garden. We were bringing back a lot of heirloom crops, and we looked far and wide from different historic seed companies and fruit growers, as well as from Seed Savers Exchange, which was an organization that started in the mid 1970s and is still going. It's quite a vibrant organization today. We went to National Seed Storage Laboratories, where seeds are kept in cold storage for the future, and that's where we got our tennis ball lettuce, for example. And so a lot of our emphasis was returning historic crops to Monticello. And we also, of course, had a restored flower garden that the Garden Club of Virginia established recreated in the 1940s. And we've certainly maintained that, even though it's not probably exactly as archaeologically based garden, but it is a garden that reflects Jefferson's ornamental landscape. I think garden interpretation has evolved a great deal since I started. We've done a great deal of research into the enslaved people who lived at Monticello and worked at Monticello, and we've learned so much in the last 25 to 30 years about their lives. We've had a program called Getting Word that has been focused on tracking down descendants of the enslaved who lived at Monticello and getting their stories. The many oral histories have been recorded through this research, and it's remarkable how much we've learned, and also studying just the writings from the period. Before we would just talk about, the slaves did this or that, but we didn't have names to people, and now we've learned more about their skills and their life history and how they were associated with Jefferson. And we try to bring those stories to life, and these are difficult subjects, and it's often not easy to explain what the life was like in those days. But it was certainly, I think, very important for us to really reveal the landscape of slavery, as well as just talking about Jefferson and his love of flowers and vegetables. Our interpretation, this is really a broad-based interpretation, not just with the gardens, but also the house. The house tour really incorporates a lot of this theme. And we even have an entire tour called Slavery at Monticello, which takes place on Mulberry Row. And this is considered Monticello's main street. It's right above the vegetable garden. And so this tour is incredibly well attended. People are quite interested in learning about this. And so we've even reconstructed some of the buildings on Mulberry Row, including the Hemmings cabin, where John and Priscilla Hemmings lived, and a cabin that was used for iron rod and storage for iron that was used to make nails and that sort of thing at Monticello. So it's ongoing, but it's an exciting time for Monticello, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad to see those important stories being told and so much more research being done lately. And it's up front and central as part of the Monticello education experience.
Yes, we had a project called the Mountaintop Project, in which we were able to restore the final section of the connection of Mulberry Row to the All-Weather Passage and the South Kitchen. Before that, when you were at just near the house, near the terraces, you really even couldn't see Mulberry Row in many ways, and you never saw the connection of the kitchen to the vegetable garden and to the enslaved who lived and worked on that site. So there's been a lot of transition in the landscape of Monticello, and of course, as well as in the house. So this has been ongoing, but we've restored some of the rooms under the south terrace, including a room dedicated to the Getting Word Project, and then another room that's interpreting the life of Sally Hemmings, which is a very powerful exhibit in there as well.
Mm. And I know that you have a newish visitor center experience. So those who haven't visited Monticello in, you know, a decade or more should definitely come back and see that new entranceway and the native gardens that are situated around it. And it's just a beautifully constructed building. And am I correct that it's LEED certified?
That's right. It's gold LEED certified. The visitor center, opened in 2009, and it was as I said, a gold LEED certified structure. So it is using all local building materials, stone, wood. It has three green roofs. The courtyard where you first enter, with large trees and everything, is really it's all growing in 3 feet of soil, and below it is the inner workings of the structure. It's classrooms are under this courtyard, and they're all kind of buried into the ground. It's a geothermal heating and cooling. The water that runs off the roofs are funneled into a greenway. They're channeled underground, and then they kind of emerge, and it's a like a little stream that runs through the center of the parking lot. And there are native plants all around that, and of course, all the plants around the visitor center are native. And some large trees were brought in to make it appear as if the building was just always there. But so it had a mature landscape planted pretty quickly around the building. So it's definitely was a masterpiece in my mind and a great transition from what we previously had, which was kind of an open air pavilion where people bought tickets and got on a bus. So now it's a much nicer experience. So yeah. And we even have a gardener. We have a native plant gardener who works there full time in that area, because we have so many native plantings there, and all through the parking lot area are also native trees and perennials and shrubs. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't help thinking that were Thomas Jefferson alive today, that he would be adapting all of these latest building techniques, and he would be definitely at the forefront of green building phenomenon.
Yeah, you know, well, it's interesting because even even at Monticello, he incorporated skylights in the house. The natural lighting in the house is remarkable, and he was using things like what we would call storm doors or windows, and so there were techniques. You know, it's probably not in for the same reasons we do these things today, but there were many elements of the house that made a lot of sense. And, you know, channeling the rainwater from the house, he channeled the rainwater into Philadelphia gutters that then ran into four cisterns at the corners of the terraces. So he was trying to save the rainwater to use it for the garden and for, you know, consumption. The cisterns would leak, so they weren't that successful, but it was a very well thought out architectural design plan to incorporate these cisterns that you really don't even know they're there. I mean, they're built into the ground, and you don't even see gutters coming off the house because they're internal. So,
Yeah, I never noticed the gutters on the house, but I knew that there were cisterns underneath. And one, as a gardener, notices, especially on the vegetable terrace, that all the water has to be hand brought in, that he obviously didn't have an irrigation system, and that the stream is at the bottom of the mountain, so to speak. So everything had to be brought up that wasn't rainwater.
Yeah, the Ravana River is about a mile away, and it's down at the bottom of the mountain. So I believe there were times when the garden could get quite dry in drought periods. There are springs around the mountain, and Jefferson knew where they were, and of course the enslaved would take wagons down to these springs and collect the water from them. Well, there was one that was fairly close to the top of the mountain called the North Spring, but again, this is really an onerous labor to haul water up, and it must have been quite difficult to keep plants alive when we have our regular drought periods, which often happen. He did have a plan, though. At one point he wanted to create, there were, you know, the Montalto, the big mountain above Monticello, he called it Montalto, and it apparently had a natural spring. And so there was, at one point during his musings, he was thinking of creating a waterfall from that spring that you would see from the west lawn of Monticello. But then he wanted to channel that waterfall over to his gardens with a series of aqueducts. And so this was all just kind of in his mind and on paper, but he never realized it. But, you know, it's kind of an amazing thought, you know, that he was contemplating a way in which he could resolve the problems with watering his garden in such a beautiful fashion, if it could have been done.
That would have been beautiful, but yes, very ambitious. And, so for the circle of annual flowers that are around the walk at Monticello, most of those are heirloom, or all of those are from heirloom? And are they all grown from seed, or are some of them started seedlings?
All across the board. The winding walk that runs around the leveled west lawn, it's a very meandering walk with narrow borders on either side. And we're growing, well, there are perennials there, some peonies and echinacea and things like that. But for the most part, especially at this time of year, the main visual you see there are the summer annuals. And most of them are either grown from, grown in a greenhouse. We do have production greenhouses at Monticello that are off the public view, but a lot of them also just come up from seed every year. And the flower gardener, Debbie Donnelly, is very observant of what's coming up in the garden, and she'll thin things out so that, for example, we have full beds of like Snow on the Mountain, and we have sensitive plant that and other flowers that have come up that are annuals that come up year after year, and they've just reseeded themselves. And so it's a mixture. But there are heirloom plants. Most of them are flowers we've had for years. It's a mixture of ornamental flowers. A lot of them are just species that flowers that were popular in Jefferson's day. Of course, he recorded many of them that were growing. But we also grow a lot of native plants in the garden. Probably about 100 different species of native wildflowers are grown in the garden. Cardinal flower is one of our favorites, and the great blue lobelia. And again, those are perennials that come back year after year. We even have a beautiful bed of bloodroot that flowers in the springtime. It's just really spectacular in the garden, more so. And Virginia bluebell is another flower that Jefferson observed when he was a young man, growing on the slopes of Monticello. And we have beds of that in the garden today. And that's just a beautiful time of year in the spring. We also grow a lot of bulbs, and we're hoping we can replant bulbs again this fall. And Jefferson grew tulips and hyacinths and daffodils and lilies and fritillarias and that sort of thing. So the springtime is also very popular in the garden for these wonderful, beautiful, colorful bulbs that are in bloom.
And where was he sourcing back in the day, especially for all those bulbs?
Yeah, he did have sources. Various people, nurserymen like Bernard McMahon was one of his major sources of seeds and bulbs and plants. He had a nursery and seed house in Philadelphia. And Bernard McMahon was pretty well known as an author as well. He wrote The American Gardener's Calendar, and it was first published in 1806. And McMahon wisely, I think, sent Jefferson a copy of his book that first year it was published. And so Jefferson at the time was planning his retirement garden. He was still president in 1806, but he was obviously referring to McMahon's book, because often Jefferson had directions in his notes to his memoranda to his overseer and to his granddaughters that were sort of word for word out of McMahon's book on planting bulbs and flowers. And McMahon was sending Jefferson some unusual tulips, for example, and he was sending him seeds of lots of flowers. And so he was one of his main sources, but he also was getting plants from nurserymen in Washington, for example, the Thomas Main Nursery out of Washington, D.C., where he was president. And so when he retired in 1809, a lot of the flowers were already being planted in the garden. He also was receiving seeds and from people from abroad. For example, André Touin, who was the superintendent of the gardens at the Botanical Garden in Paris, was sending huge amounts of packages of seeds and plants from all over the world to Jefferson almost every year. So in fact, he was sending so much material that Jefferson was sharing it with his friends because he wasn't able to, you know, deal with it all. But he was very generous in sending Jefferson. And Jefferson had great friendships with gardeners all over. Another source of seeds and plants for Jefferson were his neighbors. George Divers, who lived at Farmington, which is now a country club today, he was quite an excellent gardener and was able to provide seeds for Jefferson, mostly of vegetables, when Jefferson wasn't able, when they weren't able to save certain crops in the garden every year. And people such as John Hartwell Cock at Bremo Plantation provided seeds and crops to Jefferson as well. So there was quite a neighborhood of gardeners who shared with Jefferson, and he shared with them as well.
And I imagine there was a lot of course, seed saving done from year to year in the garden itself.
Very, very important. Yes. And of course, we're still doing that today, just as they did in Jefferson's day. But there's quite a bit of information in Jefferson's garden book and in his letters where he talks about certain crops failed or we weren't able to collect seed this year. And so he was asking for replacement crops from his friends. And seed saving was critical, of course, year after year. And for us today to preserve a lot of these heirloom varieties, it's a very important exercise. I mean, we're already saving seed now, and we'll be saving seed of over the course of the next few months of a lot of crops, especially tomatoes and beans and so forth, peas. And in the flower gardens, again, we're saving some very unusual species flowers that we grow, such as the single-flowered African marigold. And, you know, of course, we save the popular coxcomb seed and Lovelies bleeding and Peruvian zinnias and different flowers like that. And, of course, when we had our Heritage Harvest Festival, seed saving was even a workshop that we offered every year for during that program as well. And I think you attended some of those.
Yes. I was happy to be a past speaker at the festival, and to be able to attend was such a treat, to be able to walk around and have that seed saving in person demonstration around the garden was fabulous. And then there's, of course, your gift shop, which also sells some of the seeds saved from the garden.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We have a large display of seeds that we collect and package here at on site, and you can certainly go to our online catalog and buy seeds year round from Monticello. Just go to monticello.org and look for the shop section, and you'll find a great selection of all our flower, vegetable, herb seeds online as well. So definitely a great resource for our gardening friends out there in the world.
Mm-hmm. And I do recall a few stories of Jefferson's gardening, that he would have competition for the first pea, I think, of the season, and then for the tallest, is it sunflower? I can't remember if it was sunflower or not.
Well, there was that. The pea contest is probably the most famous that Jefferson participated in, and it was with his in the neighborhood. So his friends were encouraged to see who could bring the first dish of English pea to table in the springtime, and the winner would host a dinner with all the neighbors to come and enjoy this to feast on the peas, and also probably a very lavish dinner. And, you know, you would think Jefferson would win this contest every year because of the situation of his garden. He was he'd start planting peas sometimes in late February, early March, really getting it in the ground early. According to his garden book, that's when a lot of this activity would start. But it turns out that the gentleman I mentioned earlier, George Divers of Farmington, was probably a better gardener in some ways, and somehow he was always winning this contest every year. And so it's a delightful story, though, that one year Jefferson actually did win it. And he was encouraged to announce this to all the neighbors. And he said, oh, no, just let Mr. Divers win it again, because, you know, I don't want to take his glory away from him. So he was kind of being magnanimous about it. But, you know, he didn't. I'm sure it was just a great celebration every spring, and as you can imagine.
And maybe he didn't want to take on the hosting.
Oh, I won't go that far, but yeah, you probably. I'm not sure how many people participated in it, but it could have been a big crowd. Yeah.
Was there a favorite flower that Jefferson liked to bring to table, maybe as a cutting flower?
Well, that's a good question. He did grow a wide variety. I think his granddaughters were very interested in flowers. In the gardens as well. And so there's a lot of documentation about the excitement over the tulips when they first flowered in the springtime. And tulips are mentioned quite a lot. But there's also mention of flowers like the Caracalla bean, which is the snail vine. Jefferson wrote that it's the most beautiful bean in the world. So he obviously liked that flower. He also liked the heliotrope. He said that the smell rewards the care. It's the fragrant heliotrope is one of the flowers that we enjoy growing every year. We just grow the species form, the wild form, that grows from, it's native to Peru, I believe, or South America. You know, he was growing African marigolds and some of those flowers that are also from South America. So yeah, I think, probably like most of us, he might have enjoyed flowers as they they were in season, so to speak, just the same as the vegetables. For example, he was growing an army captain from San Antonio, Texas, sent Jefferson a pepper one year, which we call the Texas bird pepper. It's really grows wild down in the southern part of the United States, down into Mexico. And it's a very hot pepper. I believe they call it chile piquin in Texas. We call it a bird pepper because it's so hot that only birds can eat it, because birds don't have this sense of taste that tastes the heat in a pepper. But it's a very pretty little pepper. It's almost decorative in the garden, and so it's one of our favorites. And it's one that Jefferson was growing because he was hoping to have a pepper that was hardier, that could withstand some of the early frost that, you know, most peppers succumb to. And it is a pretty tough pepper. Yeah, he was also growing or trying to grow, cultivate some of the crops that Lewis and Clark brought back from the West when they were on their journey from 1803 to 1806. The Lewis and Clark expedition was intended to, travel across the continent to map and make observations of the landscape, and to return plants and seeds of any kind of economic crops that they could find, as well as ornamentals. And so they did bring back some beans, for example. The Arikara bean was one that Jefferson had planted and cultivated in the garden for a few years. And we have a number of these Lewis and Clark associated crops in the garden today that are very popular and very interesting to tell people about, you know, the differences and the types of crops that Native Americans were growing from North Dakota.
I do recall reading in Andrea Wolf's Founding Gardeners book that he had a little bit of a rivalry with some of the other founding members, just for, I guess, bragging rights about some of the new introductions to the garden.
Do you have an example? I'm trying to think what she mentioned. You know, like Jefferson, you know, a lot of people want to say he introduced tomatoes to the gardening, but, you know, that wasn't really true. I mean, he was an early, he documented tomatoes, and they were grown in the vegetable garden at Monticello beginning in 1809. But there were other people growing tomatoes in Virginia and many years before that. And of course, he was very interested in fruits as well. And he had an enormous fruit garden on the south slope of the vegetable, you know, of Monticello, just below the vegetable garden terrace. And there were probably 1,000 trees at its height of cultivation then in his lifetime. And probably around 1812 was a huge year for the fruit garden. He once wrote that we abound in the luxury of the peach. And so he loved, I think he had about 30 different varieties of peach trees growing in the orchard there, and apples as well, and figs. Figs were important in the garden, and he was very proud to be able to bring figs to table, because it's not easy to grow figs in central Virginia. And they were protected, of course, by the vegetable garden wall, which is in some points it's over 10 feet. And it was a massive stone wall that supported the terrace. So he was growing figs that were brought back from France, for example, the Marseille fig. And there were other fruits in the garden, such as peaches, apples, cherries, pears, plums, apricots, nectarines, raspberries, gooseberries, and currants. And of course, he wanted to grow the European grape and to produce his own wine, but we don't believe he ever succeeded in producing wine. Although there were several attempts and a number of failures in his vineyard. So that's something that we've recreated the vineyard, but we've tried to be successful with it by grafting the grapes onto the European grape onto our domestic wild grape, which helps ensure its vigor and vitality, because the European grape is a kind of a sensitive, shallow-rooted grape, and it succumbs to droughts and diseases that they encountered when they were grown in the soils of North America. So our native grape is very tough and resilient and deep-rooted, and so using that as an understock is what vintners do all over the world now. These are domestic grapes.
And the apple trees he was growing, were those grafted or were those on their own rootstock?
I believe they were budded or grafted. Yes. Uh-huh. And again, the varieties of apples have dwindled in the last 200 years. But in Jefferson's day, there were hundreds of different varieties of apples, you know, that were useful for everything from, you know, eating out of hand to making cider, to cooking, to preserving, drying. So seemed like every apple had its own use. And cider was, of course, very important as well at Monticello and cider making. There was an entire cider orchard on the north slope of the mountain on the opposite side of the vegetable garden. And today we have the predominant tree in that orchard is the Hughes crab, which was a cider apple that we were able to reintroduce after it was rediscovered near Williamsburg. And it was one of Jefferson's favorite cider apples. Yeah, we still haven't found the Tolliver apple. So if anyone knows that one, he said it was the finest cider. I believe that's the one he said produced cider like silky champagne. So
wow, that would be lovely to rediscover.
Yeah.
Can you describe a typical work day for you? I know you wear many hats at Monticello.
Well, you know, my schedule's not very typical nowadays because of the COVID pandemic. And so we are, a lot of us are working remotely, and I do work from home many days. But when I go in, I'm able to, you know, I do a lot of research. I keep plant records, and but I also spend time in the garden, and sometimes I can work in the garden, of course, but also just spend time with the gardeners and discussing, you know, how the gardens are, you know, our plans for the future of the garden, what we'll be growing in the fall, for example, some new crops or flowers that we'll have. I also am involved with garden interpretation. So part of my job was training guides and observing their tours. And so actually, when I was first hired back in 1983, one of my first job was to start a garden tour program. And so I was involved with that for about 10 years before I switched jobs and went to the Center for Historic Plants. And that's a whole different program that's going on at Tufton Farm. But it's all part of the umbrella of Monticello and plant preservation, and garden history and interpretation. So I was there for 17 years before coming back to Monticello as in my current position. But as you said in the introduction, I do give lectures. So I do a lot of preparation for talks and writing articles and editing. I do a lot. Actually, I do a lot of editing of our publications, as well as the seed catalogs that go out. And I even spend time administering the Monticello Farm and Garden Facebook page. And that's something that I enjoy doing, posting photographs of the garden and talking about different plant histories. And just about every day we post on our Facebook page. So everyone's invited to join. Send a request, and we will happily welcome you to our group.
And I do know that you also share on Instagram photos from the Monticello Garden.
That's right. Yeah, we do have a lot of social media outlets at Monticello. Recently, we've been doing live stream videos, and there was one of me recently. About 2 months ago. It was an interview, and it's on, and you can still pull these up on our website. The live stream programming has been a lot of fun, and especially since we were closed for 3 months from March 15th until the middle of June. And so we started doing a lot of programming online, digital programming, and even live stream garden tours. And I've done some private tours via that medium, and it's been a lot of fun to have groups that have signed up. You know, there'll be like, you know, 30, 40 people on a Zoom tour, and I'm walking around talking to the camera, basically. So that's another part of what I do. And it's every day's a little bit different, I think.
I imagine that's what keeps it interesting.
Yes,
and the Heritage Harvest Festival that we had mentioned earlier takes place usually second weekend of September, usually obviously not conflicting with Labor Day weekend, but this year it's taking a break. I assume to return next year, hopefully after the COVID crisis is over with.
Yes, we're going to be offering a series of a long series of programming that would have been offered on one day at the Harvest Festival. And so there'll be a program with me and Jennifer Jewell and Ira Wallace as one of the offerings. And she wrote a book recently about women in gardening, the earth in her hands. And I'm featured in the book, which was quite an honor. So we'll have an interview with us, but there'll also be speakers and workshops. And so the main thing is to go online and to get reminders of these upcoming events. You can sign up for them or register for them. And we're hoping to even be able to offer some kind of virtual wreath workshop programming later in the year. Our wreath workshops are one of our more popular events that take place at the end of November and early December. And so since we probably won't be able to have any of that on site, we're looking to come up with some ideas of offering a taped tutorial and instructing people on making wreaths on their own at home. But we've done the wreath workshops really for at least 35 years. That's been a very popular program.
I was just going to say for our listeners, Jennifer Jewell is the author of the book that you'd referred to. And Ira Wallace is with Southern Exposure Seed Exchange, which is just down the road from Monticello and has a close tie with both the festival and Monticello, of course.
Absolutely. Yes. And Ira is featured in the book as well. And she's always such an important part of our Heritage Harvest Festival. From the very beginning, it was really her idea to start this festival. So she's the founding mother of it for many, many reasons.
And they should follow Monticello on Facebook and also visit Monticello.org would be the website.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that'll lead you to a lot of fun things in the garden. And to keep in touch with what we're up to, because, you know, we're staying quite busy and coming up with some really interesting ways of connecting to people, maybe in better ways than we could before by using more of our digital resources, our technology for live streaming and that sort of thing. So in some ways, it's opened up an opportunity for us that we didn't have time to do before. And so now we have the opportunity to do this.
And I know that you were just involved in a live Zoom chat with other historic garden properties in our area, Gunston Hall and Mount Vernon, I think.
That's right. Yeah, Dean Norton, who has been at Mount Vernon for 50 years. He's an old friend. And Ryan Doskal from Gunston Hall. The three of us had a delightful conversation just last Friday. And I believe you can look it up on the Gunston Hall website. And it's about a 40-minute discussion. And we opened it up to questions. And we had a lot of chat questions coming in. And it really worked out quite well. I did it in my office at work, so you can see some my bookcase behind my head. So, and Dean was at Mount Vernon in his office, and we were all at our respective sites. So, but we had also included some slides or images from our three sites to show some of the restoration work that has been ongoing over the years, and I think people would find it quite interesting to watch. Yeah.
No, there's a Southern Garden History Association. Are you heavily involved in that?
The Southern Garden History Society. That's right. In fact, we were supposed to, it's an organization that's all over covers gardening all over the South, but people are members from all over the country. But this past spring, we had to cancel the annual meeting, which was going to be at Mount Vernon. So it's going to be rescheduled for next April, and hopefully we'll be through this and we can have an on-site meeting again. But it's this organization has a publication called Magnolia, and I do a lot of editing and work on that publication. And the website, which is southerngardenhistory.org, is a great resource for garden history, for research. It's definitely worth a visit to see all the various links. You can access all of the journals going back to the 1990s online, and you can find out about historic sites all over the South. But it's an organization for just anyone who's interested in gardening and garden history. It's not just a professional organization at all. And it's a very social group, and the annual meetings are one of the highlights of this organization.
Yeah, I recalled them meeting at Monticello, I want to say almost 15 years ago previously, and being able to take part in that. And they are a very gregarious group and open to anybody that's interested in the topic. So definitely check that out.
Yeah, we've been in Nashville and New Orleans and Charleston and the meetings are held and focused in different cities and towns every year. So definitely worth looking into.
Thank you so much, Peggy Cornett. You've given our listeners many avenues to explore and check out online, and those online talks and videos that are available and upcoming ones. And I hope that many of us will be able to get down to Monticello soon to visit in person. If not this year, then sometime next year.
Yes, we're definitely open to the public, and a lot of outside activities, of course. So yeah, it's definitely a good time to come. The gardens are looking tremendous right now, and we had a good spring, cool weather, and regular rains. So it's really never looked better. So if you're in the area, it's definitely worth a trip to Monticello.
Wonderful. Thank you again, Peggy.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Plant profile, Echinacea. The coneflower, Echinacea purpurea, is a perennial flower native to the open wooded areas in eastern and central North America. It is a favorite plant for pollinators, from bees to butterflies. They are wonderful as cut flowers for arrangements and a great low-maintenance choice for the landscape. Due to new breeding programs, coneflowers have exploded in popularity with a diversity of flower colors, shapes, and sizes. The straight species is a rosy purple, but new cultivars now come in a wide choice of colors ranging from bright shades of orange and yellow, soft whites and greens, and brilliant hues of pinks and purples. The new selections also have unique flower forms, such as double petal flowers and more dwarf compact plants suitable for container gardens. A few selections I especially like include Green Envy, Cheyenne Spirit, and Pixie Meadowbright. Echinacea prefer full sun and well-draining soil, but can tolerate part sun and clay soils. They will bloom from early summer through frost. Frequent deadheading, removing the spent blooms, will promote reblooming for your coneflowers. At the end of the growing season, leave some coneflowers up to go to seed. These provide food for birds and for native beneficial insects who spend the winter inside the hollow stems. It provides a cozy home. Guerrilla gardening, planting seeds of hope in the community. Like mythical fairies, the group of young urban residents crept into an abandoned lot late at night and left flowers in their wake. They planted in parking lot edges and along median strips. They even filled in some potholes. Knowing that their deeds might be ephemeral and not last a full day, they still gathered and expended their time, energy, and resources in an effort to inspire similar deeds in their community. I accompanied these so-called guerrilla gardeners one evening in Washington, D.C. a few years ago and found them to be motivated by a number of different factors. Some were interested in gardening and had no space of their own. Others were living eco-friendly lifestyles and saw the plantings as a political statement against all the concrete and asphalt in our cities. Still others just saw the plantings as fun outings to participate in and liked the thrill of a small amount of danger in doing something ostensibly forbidden. The practice has been around since our ancient ancestors took a violet or other wildflower from the woods and transplanted it next to their huts, enjoying the flower's beauty daily in their community. But it only gained a name a decade ago when groups of intrepid residents of New York City and London gathered for nighttime gardening installations at bare land around their city. Since then, guerrilla gardening has spread worldwide and even spawned an industry of making seed bombs, clay balls impregnated with annual flower seeds that can be thrown over the fences into abandoned lots. Most guerrilla gardening installations are ornamental plants, though more and more are planting edibles and herbs. Often they include direct sowing sunflowers, since this tough plant serves multiple purposes. Sunflowers are attractive and need little care. They also provide a food source for wildlife and humans alike. Further, they self-sow and can return annually on their own once a patch is established. Finally, sunflowers can help the soil by removing harmful soil toxins, a process called phytoremediation. Guerrilla gardeners know that their efforts may be stolen or destroyed, but they live for the notes of gratitude and the smiles on the face of passersby. If you are inspired to do some guerrilla gardening of your own, here are a few tips to get you started. Scope out a neglected piece of land or empty planter boxes. Visit it at different seasons and times of day. See how the area is used or not. Choose a location to where you live or work and appoint yourself its guardian to start watching over it. Select plants that are tough and can withstand the living conditions at your location. Some suggestions include ground cover sedums, zonal geraniums, black-eyed Susans, and juniper. Invite like-minded friends to join in and schedule a planting project. Make small signs at the location and post on social media to let people know of your project. Keep the plants alive and looking good by regular watering and pruning and weeding. Once you start, you will see neglected land wherever you look. Empower yourself to reclaim these precious resources and cultivate them in our community. Before I share what's blooming in my garden this week, I wanted to thank a new listener supporter, Kevin R. McIntosh. Thanks so much for your support, Kevin. This past week, It's been rainy on and off and fairly gloomy in the mid-Atlantic, but we needed those rains, so I am definitely not complaining. And for sunshine, I have plenty of yellow blooms in my garden, from the really tall and formidable cup flower to Rudbeckia laciniata, which is kind of a thin, tall plant. It's also known as the green-headed coneflower or cutleaf coneflower. I got it actually from a construction site rescue mission where it was going to be torn out from an old police station in our neighborhood, and I put it along my back fence line to spring up, and sure enough it has, so much so that I'm using fishing line to tie it back from leaning into the sidewalk and bopping passersby in the head. Other spots of bright yellow in my garden, of course, include the state flower of Maryland, Black-Eyed Susan. It's in discrete patches all over my garden, and I keep moving it around. It keeps moving itself around. Every year, it's a surprise sometimes where it shows up, even into part shade conditions. And then goldenrod is just starting to color up. That'll last for at least the next month or so and makes a wonderful pollinator plant. And I love to have it mixed in cut flower bouquets. It makes a great filler. And then finally, there's sunflower. This year, I seeded in a shorter variety that should get about 3 feet tall, and it's just forming its flower buds. Past years, I've done those giant sunflowers. I've also done the teddy bears and the filled-in, but I like this mid-range sunflower. It gives you something at a nice height for passing by and makes a good cut flower as well. Hoping you have sunshine in your garden as well as plenty of rain. Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter by going to anchor.fm/Kathy-Gents/support. For as little as 99 cents a month, you can become a listener supporter and we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. Another way to support Garden DC is to go to WashingtonGardener.com and subscribe to Washington Gardener Magazine. You can find Washington Gardener online at WashingtonGardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDC Gardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.